So reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 29, Text 48. The chapter is entitled, Talks Between Narada and King Sajjinaga.
Svam lokam namiduste vai.
Svam lokam namiduste vai.
Yatra devo janardana.
Samlokam
na vidhuste vai.
Samlokam na vidhuste vai.
Yatra devo janardana.
Yatra devo janardana.
Ahur dhumra dhyo vedam.
Ahur dhumra dhyo vedam.
Sakarmakam atat vidha.
Sakarmakam atat vidha.
Samlokam na vidhuste vai.
Samlokam na
Yatra devo janardana.
Yatra devo janardana.
Ahur dhumra dhyo vedam.
Ahur dhyo vedam.
Sakarmakam atat vidha.
Sakarmakam atat vidha.
Svamlokam na vidhuste vai.
Svamlokam na vidhuste vai.
Yatra devo janardana.
Yatra devo janardana.
Personality of Godhead. Janardana. Krishna or Vishnu. Ahu. Speak. Dhumradhiya. The less intelligent class of men. Vedam. The four Vedas. Sakarmaka.
Full of ritualistic ceremonies.
Atat vidha, persons who are not in knowledge. Translation Prabhupada by his Vaindris Isi Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki.
Yeah.
Those who are less intelligent accept the Vedic ritualistic ceremonies as all in all. They do not know that the purpose of the Vedas is to understand one's own home, where the Supreme Personality of Godhead lives. Not being interested in their real home, they are illusioned and search after other homes. Please repeat. Those who are less intelligent accept the Vedic ritualistic ceremonies as all in all. They do not know that the purpose of the Vedas is to understand one's own home, where the Supreme Personality of Godhead lives. Not being interested in their real home, they are illusioned and search after other homes. Generally, people are not aware of their interest in life to return home back to Godhead. People do not know about their real home in the spiritual world. In the spiritual world, there are many Vaikuntha planets, and the topmost planet is Krishna Loka, Golok Vrindavan. Despite the so-called advancement of civilization, there is no information of the Vaikuntha Lokas, the spiritual planets. At the present moment, so-called advanced civilized men are trying to go to other planets, but they do not know that even if they go to the higher planetary system, Brahmaloka, they have to come back again to this planet. This is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita 8:16. A Brahma Bhuvana Loka Punar Avartino Arjuna Mam Vidya Dukontaya Punar Janma Navidyate. From the highest planet in the material world down to the lowest, all are places of misery wherein repeated birth and death take place. But one who attains to my abode, O son of Kunti, never takes birth again. If one goes to the highest planetary system within this universe, he still has to return after the effects of pious activities are finished.
You need tissue.
Yeah, tissue. Oh yeah, okay. Sorry. Thank you. If one goes from the highest planet in the material world down to the lowest, all are places of misery wherein repeated birth and death take place. But one who attains to my abode, O son of Kunti, never takes birth again. If one goes to the highest planetary system within this universe, he still has to return after the effects of pious activities are finished. Space vehicles may go very high in the sky, but as soon as their fuel is finished, they have to return to this earthly planet. All these activities are performed in illusion. The real attempt should now be to return home back to Godhead. The process is mentioned in Bhagavad Gita. Yanti mad yajino vimam. Those who engage in the devotional service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead return home back to Godhead. Human life is very valuable, and one should not waste it in vain exploration of other planets. One should be intelligent enough to return to Godhead. One should be interested in information about the spiritual Vaikuntha planets, and in particular the planet known as Golok Vrindavan, and should learn the art of going there by the simple method of devotional service, beginning with hearing Shravanam Kirtanam Vishnu. This is also confirmed in the Srimad Bhagavatam 12.3.51. Kale doshe nide rajan asti hyeko mahan guna kirtana deva krishnasya mukta sangha param raje. One can go to the supreme planet param raje simply by chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. This is especially meant for the people of this age, Kaler Dosha Nidhe. It is a special advantage of this age that simply by chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, one can become purified of all material contamination and return home back to Godhead. There is no doubt about this. Om Gyanam Timranthasya Gyananjana Shilakaya Chakshuru Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Mano Vishram Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Tadam Mayam Dadati Svapadantikam Vanchakalpatarubhyasya Kripasundu Yevacha Patitanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Namaha Svam Lokam Naviduste Vai Yatra Devo Janardana Ahur Dhumda Dhyavidam Sakarmakam Atatveda. So this is the continuation of the talks between Narada and King Prachinapari. So Narada Muni here is telling Prachinaparishad, who was the king at that time, a very great king. And he's telling him not to engage in Vedic ritualistic sacrifices, to not engage in any more of these sacrifices, because the king was engaged in many such sacrifices. Being a great king, he was performing all these ashwamedha yagyas, all these different fire sacrifices, and all of this was fruitive work. It was for his own advancement, for the advancement of his prosperity. And Narada inspires the king to listen to him and to take his words seriously by doing a certain magical feat. And what is that? What did Narada Muni do first to Prachinapari in order to scare him a little bit?
He showed him after that his death all these animals appears.
Yes, yes. So before he started speaking to him, he came to the king. And he told him, "What are you doing?" And he showed him what would happen after his death. And then the king, he saw that all these animals that he had sacrificed in the fire, they were there with their iron horns and with their different natural body parts, and tearing his body apart. They were piercing him, taking revenge for the cruelty that he had done to them, and as a result they had suffered. So he had gained the credit of the pious activity. And the nice thing about these Vedic yagyas is that the animal also benefits in the process. So they also move, but still it's painful. They still have to die, and it's very tricky, the whole system of sacrifices. So when he saw this, then the king became very afraid, and then he started to inquire from Narada Muni that what is the real path to truth. And later on, you'll see at the end of this, he complains to Narada Muni, and he says that, why isn't it that all my other teachers until now didn't teach me this? Why was I misled until now? Why didn't I receive this real knowledge? So here, Narada Muni is encouraging Prachinapari to give up this ritualistic dharma. So this is how the Bhagavatam begins. The Bhagavatam is reflecting on the Mahabharata. Right? We see the Bhagavatam begins with the story of Bhishma, and Arjuna and the Pandavas. And the Mahabharata story is just ending. And it's just coming to an end. And as the Mahabharata is ending, the Bhagavatam is beginning. So actually it's interesting that Srila Prabhupada, he says this. He says that how first you read the Bhagavad Gita, then once you've done that, then we're ready for the Bhagavatam. So you see, the Bhagavatam is starting where the Mahabharata is ending. The Mahabharata is just finishing. The five sons of the Pandavas die. We read about the Pandavas going to the forest and attaining liberation. So the Mahabharata is just finishing, and the Bhagavatam starts. And just as an interesting side note, what is the last verse of the Bhagavatam? It was the very, very last verse of the entire Bhagavatam. It's very interesting. And the last verse, it says, Canto 12 is describing the age of Kali, like this, the different symptoms of the age of Kali. So the last verse says that those who are intelligent in this age of Kali, they will take to the congregational chanting of the holy name of the Lord. It glorifies the process of glorifying the name of the Lord, of chanting the name of the Lord. So we see that the Bhagavatam, it brings us all the way to the point of, okay, now we're in Kali Yuga, the situation is very bad. We've learned all these lessons from these great personalities, from their different activities. And now, those in this age who are intelligent and who want freedom from bondage, they're only the intelligent, it says, that they will take to the chanting of the holy name of the Lord. And that's where the Chaitanya Charitamrita begins. Right? That's Lord Chaitanya's movement. He starts it in some ways at that point of taking the name of the Lord. So this is a very nice progression. You see a very scientific progression. So the Mahabharata, it talks about many different types of dharma. Like many, it talks about the dharma of the kings. The whole thing is a narration about dharma and dealing with the ambiguities of dharma. Is this the right thing to do in this circumstance? Is this the right thing for a king to do in this circumstance? And then it's asking about the dharma of the brahmanas. What are they supposed to do? How do they, for example, respond to suffering? And how does the kshatriya respond to suffering? It's in two different ways. The brahmana, he just sees his destiny. It's like whatever comes, I just take it. You know, he sees it's all destiny. It's all the will of the Lord. Where the kshatriya, he has to do something about it. So he tries to avoid it. He tries to stop adharma. And then it talks about the dharma of the various orders of life, of the student, of the vanaprastha, of the sannyasi, of the grihastha. And it talks about dharma of people in very odd situations, like the situation of Kunti with Karna, and all these confusing aspects of dharma. And in the Mahabharata, no one can really figure out what the right answer is. It's like there seems to be many answers. And many of the times they come to the wrong conclusion and then they do the wrong thing. They realize, oh, maybe this wasn't so right. Or they become confused in their execution of dharma. So the Mahabharata talks a lot about these Vedic ritualistic ceremonies. And the Bhagavatam, it begins by rejecting all of this. The second verse of the Bhagavatam is Dharma Projita Kaituko Paramanirmat Saranam Satam. That the Bhagavatam is presenting, is rejecting all the other dharmas. It's saying this dharma is bad, this dharma is a waste of time, this type of dharma is a waste of time. And it's Dharma Projita, it's giving that highest dharma. That is free from all cheating. So the Vedic ritualistic ceremonies, they're a cheating process in some ways. Because they're telling the practitioner, they're telling him, if you do this, you'll get this result. But at the same time, they're implicating the performer in suffering. After that, they have to suffer their actions of killing the animals. Prajinavari has to come back and suffer the results. So all of these dharmas are cheating dharmas because they don't give the ultimate result of happiness. They give some result, but in the process they cause more misery and involve the person even more. So then the Bhagavatam, it rejects all these cheating dharmas and then establishes the highest dharma. He says, okay, they are all dharmas. Actually, it doesn't reject them. It says that it's true they're dharmas, but these are lower dharmas. And the highest dharma is Savaitum San Paro Dharma, Yato Bhakti Ratokshiji, Ahaitukya Pratyale, Aliyatma Sukta Sivati. The highest dharma, this highest dharma is not something which appears in this place or that place, or is practiced by this person or that person. Highest dharma is that, is just that, whatever it may be, we don't know what it is. Whatever it may be, it is that which Savai Pumsang Paro Dharma Yato Bhakti Ratokshiji, that brings about unalloyed and unmotivated devotional service to the Lord. So that is the highest religion, that is the highest dharma. And whatever brings that about, we call that dharma. So it's actually a very wonderful definition, a very non-sectarian definition, that this dharma is open to everyone. It can be found in many different places. But whatever it is, that dharma, the highest dharma is that which leads us to Krishna. So here, Narada Muni is telling the same thing. He's saying, don't get involved in these Vedic ritualistic ceremonies, in these lower types of dharma. And give up these and focus on the highest dharma, which is pure devotion to the Lord. Just focus on that and try to find out your original home, where you've come from. This translation is so nice. It's saying that we've forgotten our original home, our svam lokam. Svam lokam means, it literally means our own abode, our own planet. That where we actually come from, this is our own planet. And it's sort of like if we grew up somewhere, at least I found that wherever you grow up, it seems to be the most comfortable place, right? Because you grow up there, just like you're accustomed to that place. It's a natural place. But then we grow up, we go to some other place, and maybe not that, but we go to some other place, and then we get some Alzheimer's disease or something like that. And we forget about our past, right? We forget about our original home. And then the translation says, not being interested in their real home, they are illusioned and they search after other homes. So we're all searching for affection and for love in this material world. We are searching for homes. Like, we create different homes, we live in different homes. When we grow up, then we live in the home of our parents. As we're growing up, that's our home. And then when we grow older, we may create our own home. And then suddenly it's a shift, and we're in a different home, and that's our home. And then the children are there. And then when a person gets older, even older, then they may live in the home of their children. So then they change home again. So they go through three or four different homes. And then now in the West is a fad that people, they like to change a lot. Before people used to live in the same home for many generations. So my grandfather's grandfather, he was in his home in India, in Allahabad. And then my grandfather, he stayed in the same house. And then their son, he stayed in the same house. For many generations, they would stay in the same house. And the house was generally built of some stone, you know, some solid stone, and it would stay for a long time. But in modern times, people like to change homes every 5-6 years. So that's why they make homes, you know, just out of wood, very little stone. And then they'll be in some house for some time, and then they'll get bored with it, or they'll earn some more money and they'll get a bigger house or change to a different home. So we're searching after so many homes in this material world, right? So many different abodes. But it's saying we've forgotten our own original home. That home, which is really home. You know, it's really the place where we feel at home. It's not an awkward situation. Srila Prabhupada, many times he describes the material world as an awkward situation. We're embarrassed by so many things. It's like we don't want the situation to come, but it still comes. And then we feel embarrassed by it, or we feel awkward in that situation. But in this, in our original home, it's very nice. Our real home. So he's saying that we should search after this original home, our svam lokam, our original abode, and give up all these false pursuits. We should stop becoming sidetracked by all these attractions that come on the way. You see, just like when we're going to a destination, and there's so many rest stops and so many attractions that come on the way. So he's telling, don't get sidetracked by all these different attractions. And this is exactly what Srila Prabhupada then in the purport is also saying. He's saying there's so many different planets, all the way up to Brahmaloka. And actually when we go to the spiritual world, Srila Prabhupada describes, we actually travel through all these different planets before we reach the spiritual world. So Krishna gives us the opportunity to choose, in the sense that if we're not completely purified, then we'll be traveling up and some planet will seem very attractive to us, based on our level of advancement. So if we're still on we're very much in the mode of goodness, but still on the central platform, then just the subterranean heavenly planets will attract us, and we'll stop there. You know, or if we're more advanced, then those won't attract us, but maybe the abode of Indra will attract us. You know, it's like very nice there. You know, like they have mangoes the size of mountains, and they fall from these trees. The trees that are 30 kilometers high, and they fall to the ground, and they're from these mangoes, and there's rivers of this mango juice that's flowing. And then the residents there, they take bath in these rivers, and they bathe in these rivers. So they're not only do you eat mangoes, but you can even bathe in mangoes. It's so nice. And then when they bathe in these in this mango juice, I mean, you can imagine it's like a spa every day. Like here people go to a spa and sometimes the very expensive treatments, they bathe in milk, they'll put them in a milk thing, or they'll put these things. But every day they're bathing in this mango juice. So their bodies become very aromatic. It smells like their natural odor is very beautiful. And for many miles you can smell the fragrance coming from their bodies. And then there they have a very long duration of life, maybe thousands of years, and then they produce children only in the last year of their life. So that's also a benefit. They can just enjoy it, not worry about kids, and then in the last year of their life they have children, and then after that, that's sort of a sign for them that okay, life is coming to an end. After that they move on to some other place. So there's so much. I mean, this is why the Bhagavatam actually describes all these things. Even though this is part of the material creation, it describes these because then it creates a sense of detachment. Even for us, even if we're attracted to material enjoyment, it gives us. It says, okay, if you really want to enjoy materially, this is the way how to enjoy. Right? At least there's. I mean, even for material enjoyment, this is the place of doing tapasya. Because if we enjoy here, we get a little bit of enjoyment. Like we get something. We may buy a nice car, but that's about it. and then there they have these swan planes also, so they don't crash, there's no accidents. And if we want that, then at least aspire for this type of material enjoyment. Why aspire for worldly and material enjoyment? At least aspire for something good. This is really enjoyment. This is a really pleasure. So we go through all these different planets, and only when we're free of all this attraction, then we actually surpass them all. So the highest living beings, they're not even attracted by this material enjoyment. I mean, personally, I would be attracted by this material enjoyment. But those are even higher than this. They're not attracted by this. But then they're attracted by, you could say, knowledge, realization of Brahman. Very high levels of enjoyment. And they stay at the place of Brahma, Brahma's abode. Right? Their Brahma's abode is mainly filled with sages, even though he's the highest demigod. They have all this material enjoyment, but they're not interested in it. So they're all sages, and they're engaged in meditation. The four Kumaras, they were before they met the Lord, they were great impersonalists. So it's they were enjoying the bliss of Brahman, because even though the bliss of Brahman, the impersonal liberation, is not desirable by a devotee, it's still even that bliss is still higher than material enjoyment. That the pleasure merging to Brahman is still higher than material life. It's not as good as spiritual life, as Krishna consciousness. So we don't want it, but those who have a taste for that, they don't want material enjoyment. So Brahma's abode is filled with sages. And the seven stars that we see in the sky, that revolve around the pole star. These are the seven sages that are going around the pole star again and again. We have to even become free of the attraction of the mode of goodness. Right? In Brahmaloka, they're fixed, they're situated, and they're attached, you can say, to the mode of goodness. And once we're not attracted by any of these things, then we look at all these things as we're going up in this cosmos, and we cross, we go beyond it, and we enter into the spiritual sky. So Narada Muni here, the devotees, and Srila Prabhupada here, he's encouraging the devotee not to get distracted by all of these attractions. And the devotee gets this full experience, he gets all these different options, the full experience of all these wonderful things. Krishna is sure that he's not attracted to this anymore. And once that happens, then the devotee is completely ready. So even in our own devotional service, as the devotee advances in spiritual life, even in this material world, Krishna may offer at a certain point the devotee many nice things, material facilities, all these things, to see the determination of the devotee. And this is actually one of the stages Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur describes. This is one of the stages of devotional service, which is where one naturally gets material opulences as a result of one's devotional service. And those material opulences, it's one of the, you could say, the pitfalls, sometimes become attractive, and the devotee can fall into that. And then it's a stage of Ananta Nirvitti that then the devotee, after falling into it, sort of realizes, I put myself into this mess, I slipped into it, like Bharat Maharaj, because there's so many examples. And then the devotee pulls himself out of it. He goes back to back on that path. So all these different processes are very risky. The process of karma is very risky, because somewhere in this whole process we perform something, and then we become entangled, and then again for a few different for some time we become involved, and our spiritual progress becomes delayed. So, better than to spend our time involved in this karma, one should become fixed, one should immediately become fixed in devotional service. Service to the Lord. Devotional service to the Lord, by which one automatically transcends all these different platforms. Just to give you an example of the problem with karma. So this is the Vedic ritualistic ceremonies. This is the karmic process. So just to show you how karma works, karma is so amazing, so wonderful. There's most of the time we don't see how it works. It just happens. It's just okay. We experience some suffering or some happiness, but we don't see how it's working. But sometimes. Interesting things happen by which we can see that how perfect Krishna's whole method is. There's the saying, right? It says that it goes something like this: that the wheel of God, of God's justice, you could say, turns very slowly, but it grinds very fine. Right? It turns very slowly, but it grinds very fine. And they tell this story actually in philosophy classes. They say that one time there's this man and woman, this old man and woman, they were sitting in their flat on the 11th story of a building. This is, I think, some place in America. And they're sitting there on the 11th story, and the old husband and wife, they're arguing. Right? They're in an argument, and they're as usual, have this argument. And so it wasn't the first time that it happened. And after this, this old man, he had this habit that he would pick up his gun and he would point it at his wife. In America, this is the horrible thing in their legal system, that they allow individuals to keep guns. It's like, they try to reduce crime by this. They think if people have guns, they can protect themselves. But very most often they end up hurting one another than protecting themselves. So he picked up his gun and he pointed it at his wife. And so in this case, this whole case came to court. And the wife didn't die. So this case, it came to court, and what had happened, a very interesting thing had happened, that a bullet had gone out from the 11th story of this building. And it just so happened that at that time, someone was on the 11th, on the top of this skyscraper building, so it's like 20 stories high, and he was on the top, on the roof of this building, and he was jumping off this building. And he jumped off, and it was obviously for suicide. He wanted to end his life. And he jumped off, and as he was falling, he got shot by this bullet that was coming out of the window. Now, the thing is that ordinarily, this person would not have died as a result of jumping off this building. Because in these very high-rise buildings, sometimes what they do is they put a net on the second floor. So if someone jumps off, they fall into this net. And so that net was there, and he would have fallen into this net as a result of jumping off from the building. But he still died, and not as a result of falling on the ground, but because the bullet hit him as he was jumping from the 20th story. Now, this case is very interesting to the lawyers or detectives, whatever you could say. And they went in and they thought, how is it that this person... why is it that this bullet came out at that time? And how is it that he died? So then they made this research and they found out that inside the building was this husband and wife who were arguing. And this man, he shot his gun and that bullet went outside the window. And it was that bullet that hit this man who was jumping. And the old man himself actually was actually quite surprised. So they then went and said, okay, so is the old man the cause of this death? Was he actually planning to kill his wife? It turns out, no, he was quite surprised because he kept a gun in his home, but it was always unloaded. There's never any bullet in that gun. He used that gun just to threaten his wife. And so he wasn't expecting that this gun would actually have a bullet. So they realized that actually someone had put a bullet inside the gun. So then they thought, well, who put the bullet inside the gun? Well, they found out later that, okay, first of all, who was this man who jumped from the building? The man who jumped from this building was the son of this old couple who were there. And what they found out, that actually the son had put the bullet in the gun, the revolver. And he had put the bullet in the revolver because he was, a bit, mentally crazy, and he had developed a fit towards his mother, a grudge towards his mother, because his mother had stopped his paycheck or something like this, something small, she had stopped his paycheck, and so he knew, the son knew that his father sometimes threatens his mother with a gun, with the empty gun. And so he put the bullet in there without the parents' knowledge because he thought when he threatens his mother, then his father will pull the bullet and that will kill his mother. And then after doing that, naturally he was so frustrated, he also decided to jump from the building and do suicide. So by chance, it was just lucky chance that this man, rather than pulling the trigger while pointing it at his wife, he pulled it while pointing it out the window. And as he was falling, this bullet hit the boy rather than the lady. And then that became, you could say, the cause of his death. So, because otherwise he would have survived. In the normal situation, he would have survived as a result of falling into the net, and his mother would have died as a result of the of being hit by the bullet. But the laws of karma are perfect. They work very well. He had put the bullet in the gun, so he deserved to die. So therefore, it hit him and not his mother. So they give this actually as an example of karma. It's very interesting. Wow, it's like like we cannot escape our own actions, our own destiny. Another example, I just remember very quickly, this one's much shorter, but another very amazing story about karma. One time, a young girl and a slightly older man were in an affair, right? So the man was in an affair with this lady for 1 or 2 months, and it was, you know, just like, you know, they were in a complete relationship. And then after that, after 1 or 2 months, the man decided that he wasn't interested in the girl anymore. So he came to the apartment of the girl, who lived on the 10th or 11th story of this building. And he came to her and he said, you know, I decided I want to end this relationship. Please don't call me anymore. If I'm interested, I'll call you. And basically, it's over now. And so he said that, and he walked out. And he went down the 12 stories, and he was walking out the building. Now, this girl was very young, and it was the first affair in her life, and, you know, and she developed an attachment for this boy. And so once she heard this, she was completely broken, heartbroken. And so she jumped out the window. And when she jumped out the window, as she was jumping, when she fell right on top of this man as he was coming out of the building. So she fell on this man, and as a result, the man died, and she just got a little injury in her head. That's all. She continued to live, and he died as a result of the impact. So, again, Krishna is, you know, he said, hey, no, you deserve to die. You know, you've acted irresponsibly, so here's the karma. Here it comes. So, yes, the laws of karma are very perfect, and they act very precisely. And so, yes, we should be afraid of our karma, right? Even as devotees, it's very Krishna is his plan is very perfect. In other words, he's very just. So it is a matter of fear for the living entity at all times. The living entity is afraid of his karma. And so therefore, here Narada is saying that don't involve yourself more and more in this karma, in the activities of this mature world. Because somewhere or the other, you know, it's going to come back to you, you'll get involved in this and that. Better to fully engage oneself in the devotional service of the Lord, in the service of the Lord. And at the same time, to avoid bad karma, to avoid bad activities. So, Krishna in the Gita, he says that when we surrender to him, he gets rid of all of our past karmas. Right? So that's very true. He's saying that once a person comes to his devotional service, once a person surrenders to him, Krishna frees that devotee from all of his baggage that he's coming in from. But this doesn't mean that once we become devotees, then whatever karma we do, ultimately, you know, we'll escape from it. We'll escape from the reaction. In fact, just like in the law, if a policeman performs a crime, he gets a greater punishment than the normal citizen, right? Because the policeman is representing the law. If the policeman does something wrong, he in fact gets even a tougher punishment. So in the same way, when the devotee, if he's representing the Lord, if he's representing the law, in some ways you can say, if the devotee performs a bad karma, then Krishna's not saying that, oh, I'll leave you scot-free. No, in fact, the reaction may be even stronger, because we're doing it in knowledge. We're aware of what we should do and what we should not. So both things have to be there in some ways. Our activities, our karma has to be in the correct path. But at the same time, ultimately, we become free of this cycle, of this very difficult situation, by surrendering to the Lord, which Prabhupada here is saying begins by hearing. Hearing about the Lord and chanting the holy names of the Lord. So by chanting Mahamantra, he specifically mentions. So, okay. Thank you very much. If anyone has any
don't believe in reincarnation. They say they consider that the point of being punished for something they did in a previous life, punishment being maybe educational method or, you know, gratifying, they say what they do is actually. So I don't know what would be the best way to answer such a question.
Yes, a very sort of good point about karma, a question that's asked very often, is that if we're suffering for the result of our past activities, our past lives, and we don't know for what fault we are suffering, then what's the purpose of karma? Like, why do we suffer to begin with? So there's two, you could say, two purposes for our forgetfulness of this. Why Krishna, generally speaking, doesn't give us this clear action and reaction situation. The first reason is that if it was so clear to us that whenever we do something wrong, we get the bad result, then we would just be good out of the fear of getting a bad result. Right? If we always saw, whenever I slapped someone, immediately I got slapped in return. Right? If it was like, whenever you said something unkind, immediately you got some reaction. It was so clear, then we just do it as a, we just be good as a means of survival. Right? And this is, you know, obvious. It's like just like we know whenever we put our finger in the fire, it'll burn. So that's why we don't put our finger in the fire. We don't do it for any higher reason. It's just for the reason that we don't want our finger to burn. But Krishna, he wants us to be good for the sake of goodness itself. You know, that this is the right thing to do. So we can see it in other people's lives. We can see that, well, if someone is mistreated, that person suffers. Right? We see the result of bad activities. So we can perceive it. But we also have this sense in the material world that we can get away with it. So that's why we're in this situation where we actually have a choice. It's a choice, do I want to be good or not? You know, we have this feeling in us that if I act badly, well, maybe I can get away with it. So it becomes more of a purification of the heart, you could say. I actually desire that I want to be good, not out of fear of punishment, which is a very low level of goodness, but because this is the right way to be. Because this is the way, this is compassion, that this is the way of being a good person. So karma would not, you could say, in some way serve its purpose if it was very clear. If we always suffer the reactions of activities in the same life, because it would just be a child who's being good because of fear of punishment from his parents, not because the child understands that no, this is actually the right way to do to be. Then the second thing is that the soul actually learns as a result of these experiences, even though we don't remember it. So, the Bhagavatam in a few different places describes this, that anything that the mind experiences, it leaves an impression on the mind. Right? So, if we have a bad experience, then even though we may not remember it in our next life, but that impression will stay in our mind. So in our next life, we'll be averse to that thing. Just like, they see this in many babies, right? Some babies, they're born, and ever since they can, you know, focus and they can see, they'll be very afraid of people with mustaches. There's one baby, he's just like, whenever he saw a man with a mustache, he would just start crying. He's completely terrified. And I wonder why is it? You know, maybe in his past life he had a bad experience with a man with a mustache. So that same you know, fear is there. Or you know, some children, they're you know, they don't cry much, or you know, they're happy in anyone's arms, you put them. Yeah, others, they're very careful, you know, they're very sensitive like that. So this is because of experiences in our past lives that we're carrying through. In the same way, some people, when they may grow up in the same situation as another person, there may be two members of the family, but one person is very much attracted to spiritual life and is not attracted to bad things. You know, he just never had an interest in taking drugs or trying various things. And the other person did, even though they grew up in the same situation. Why is that? Because one soul may be bringing in different experiences in the past life. You know, they've already experienced it in their past life, and now in this life they're not interested. So that's why it actually takes so many lifetimes for us to actually become maturely exhausted, you could say uninterested. Try out different things in the mature world and realize, no, there's no happiness anywhere. I'm not interested in this, I'm not interested in this, I'm not interested in this. I just want to surrender to Krishna. So this is why Krishna says that the unsuccessful yogi in his next life, he progresses and he gets a pious birth. Because that yogi gets the chance in some ways. It says he still has unfulfilled material desires. So Krishna puts him in an aristocratic family or in a prosperous position. Why? Is that yogi gets the chance of fulfilling those desires in some ways. Fulfilling them so that in some ways it becomes easier after that to give it up. It becomes easier to surrender to the Lord. Even though it's not, completely, it doesn't work like that exactly. But they say it's a lot easier to be humble if you've experienced respect. Right? It actually works the other way. If you feel respected, if you've been respected in your life, it's easier to be humble because you're not craving for that respect. Right? You've experienced it. It's easy to be detached if you're wanted. Right? If you're wanted, it's easy to be detached because you would think it would work the other way around, but actually the Shastras say that they say that if a person has it says that a brahmachari actually says can only remain a brahmachari if he's experienced the love of his mother. Right? So if he's experienced that love, then he's already experienced it, and after that he can become detached from it. But if he hasn't experienced that he was in a different situation, then later on it's difficult. Because Krishna, he gives that sort of that situation, that arrangement, where a person can easily sort of fulfill some desires and then focus more on spirituality. Although it doesn't always work like that. You know, some people, they're born in a different situation and they're completely attracted to spirituality.
I was just thinking,
Krishna
is
a nice way I sometimes think about material world is like a boxing ring. So you know how people are in a boxing ring and then they go in and they get punched. They go in there. It's a very interesting sport. You go in there to get beaten. Right? And then what happens is that sometimes you know you get punched a lot and you start to bleed. So the ringmaster pulls you up. And, you know he puts cotton on you and dries you up and all. He says, "Oh, you're fine." And he's drying you up just to push you back into the boxing. And then you're in there and then you get punched even more. So it's like this. This is like the higher planetary systems or material welfare, what we would say. It's like it's taking the person out of the boxing ring, you know, fixing them up just so they can go back in and get punched even more. You know, get more. So yeah, so the basic principle of material life is suffering, and then sometimes you get this relief from that. Yes.
There's a point that activities and desires for our future life.
Yes.
So then, if you want to avoid all these problems, then you desire and act for Krishna.
Yes.
And never be born again.
Yes. So ultimately, the idea is we get a higher taste and desire something higher. because the material world in some ways is so unlimited that it's impossible to fulfill all of our, it's impossible to try to become frustrated with all of our material desires, you know, to try to experience everything, basically. So the main thing is to, the key thing, we experience a higher taste than automatically induce our own desires. Oh, who's taking care of them? <It's> okay. See, I think their years are longer than ours, so 1 year is enough to bring them to maturity. So that's. Yeah.
As far as I understand, they grow immediately. So
they grow immediately.
They're born and they're immediately adults and start to enjoy.
So they don't have to go even through the pain of childhood, right?
No.
Although it's not so painful, I mean, but at that time, when you're a child, then you're always thinking, oh, I won't, you know, this is like, when will I become older, you know?
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Srila Prabhupada ki, Srila Prabhupada ki.